remember. So Andy, how much of a lockdown are you in at the moment?
Pretty significant. We've been like this we're allowed 2K out of our house. So you can get outside, but only within 2 kilometres. You're not meant to be in any groups larger than, if you live with 3 or 4 people, you can be with them, obviously, but outside of that, you can't. 2 metre distancing, social distancing, all that sort of stuff. And we've been like this now. This is day 36 like this, and I'm told at the end of this week we're going to have another 2 weeks slapped on us as well. So it'll be quite significant. So it'll end up being 7 weeks that we'll be like this. It's pretty full on.
And what happens from a professional point of view with seasons and pre-seasons and all that kind of stuff? Because I don't buy into it, but there's a whole lot of stuff on NRL and AFL pushing to, you know, isolate the players and take them to the Gold Coast or Toowoomba or whatever.
Yeah, listen, we're a little bit different because we're cross-bordered. So I think if your competition, and I know you've got the Warriors there with the NRL, but I believe they're making some changes with that. But because the Pro 14, which we're involved in, we've got the 4 Irish provinces, but even within that, we've got Ulster that's in the north of Ireland. So they're under different regulations as well because of they're under the English rule. We've got Scotland, 2 teams out of Scotland. We've got 4 teams out of Wales. We've got 2 teams out of Italy and 2 teams out of South Africa. So, yeah, we're in the hotbed of COVID. The only team we don't have is someone from the USA, which would just top the whole thing off. I just can't see that competition getting back up and running, mate.
Yeah, it's a tough one. There's I just don't think it's hard to see a way around it. I don't know if you keep up to date with the NRL and the AFL stuff, but they're really pushing, and you kind of wonder. Yeah, I don't know. I'll leave it up to the experts, I guess.
No, I have been keeping in touch with it. I was really frustrated to watch at the front end that they kept playing, you know, that they had those first couple of rounds, because that was when it was, you know, that was great. There was just indecision as to what this whole thing was looking like. And it just, from a distance, it just looked like they were being reasonably irresponsible and selfish about the whole thing, but it then shut down. But we'll wait and see how it comes back up. I do appreciate, I think probably the biggest thing there, it just shows you how the sporting model's built on a house of cards, deck of cards, really, isn't it?
Like it's so fragile. It's ridiculous.
It's fragile. And I think the one thing that'll come out of this is going forward, it's got to be built on a stronger model.
It's also been interesting watching, we are protected or meant to be protected by the Australian Strength and Conditioning Association. There's players associations. There's a whole bunch of other things. Just to see how everyone's trying to grab the little bit of the pie that's there and help.
I think in an environment that's reasonably self-interested anyway, you're just seeing that come to the floor now too. But it's interesting watching.
Alrighty, guys, we've got 16 people on here. That's awesome. All right, so guys, I think we're going to kick this off. Oh, still some more people coming in. We've got South Africans, Kiwis, Aussies. Jordan, remind me where you're from. Was it Sydney? No, Hong Kong.
I'm in Hong Kong. I'm from Ireland.
From Ireland. Yeah. All right. Yeah. All righty, guys. If I can just ask everyone to, and I think everyone has done this, turn off your microphones. There will be plenty of opportunity to ask Andy questions. There's the chat option if you're new to Zoom, so please feel free to use that. If you ask a question privately, I won't mention your name and I'll just ask Andy the question. But if you do want to go deeper in and you chat to everyone, then I will mention your name and Andy can answer that directly. Last night we had a fascinating talk with Paddy Upton, who was the mental coach with Gary Kirsten, working with India in the lead up to the 2011 World Cup, and just the lessons that he learned there, mainly from six months of backpacking around Asia. And coming up, we've got Simon Thomas, head of performance at the Crusaders. And we've also got Stefan Widmar, who's been one of my mentors especially when I was working with female athletes. He was 5-time Australian Coach of the Year. Andy, friend, welcome to this. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Grant. Good to be here.
Now, and if we can just start right back at the beginning of your career, you came on my radar, you're with the Brumbies, but before that you'd been Harlequins, and before that you'd been with the Waratahs. Were you a player of any substance?
I was certainly not known from a playing. Well, I played a lot of junior representative stuff, so I played Aussie Schoolboys 86, 87, but I had a significant knee injury, which back then, probably not a good time to have a knee reconstruction. So I had that in 1987, and by the age of 21, I'd had 5 operations. So my footy sort of pulled up pretty quickly and allowed me to get into coaching pretty quickly.
So was that the plan to get into coaching, or was it kind of like, hey, I want to be involved, I can't be on the field, I might go off field?
Yeah, it's a good question, mate. And I tell people the story. I went to a Canberra Grammar School, and in year 11, I was asked, as we all were in the class, what do you want to do? What's your career path? And I remember sitting there with a blank book in front of me thinking, I've got no idea what I want to do. And the teacher at the time walked past me and said, why aren't you writing anything? I said, because I have no idea what it is that I want to do. And he said, well, what does your father do? Which back then was sort of what you tended to do. And I said, well, my father's an accountant, but I've got no interest in numbers. And, you know, doesn't interest me at all. And he said, well, if I put you in a room of 100 people anywhere in the world, what would you be most comfortable to talk about? And I said, it would be rugby. And he said, well, don't be silly. You can't be employed in rugby, because back then you couldn't.
Yes.
But it actually sparked something in my mind that thought, actually, if that is my passion and that's what I love, why couldn't I do that? So my ambition as a young player was to play at the highest level, to try and be a Wallaby. My injury didn't allow me to get there, whether my skill set would have allowed me, no one knows that. But
what position?
I was a fullback.
Fullback, okay.
I was a fullback. Played for the ACT. I had one reconstruction and came back and played for the ACT, which was the Brumbies before it was before the Brumbies existed, or were labelled the Brumbies. But listen, yeah, that never transpired. So went and studied sports coaching at the University of Canberra. Did my 3-year diploma or degree in that, and then when I came out of that, I basically gave rugby away for a couple of years, and I went and worked for an organisation called Outward Bound, which to me gave me a great grounding in guided discovery learning. Basically, that was their whole philosophy. But more importantly, there I met my now wife. We were both Outward Bound instructors. She fell pregnant with our eldest boy, who's now 26, or about to be 26. And it was at that stage that I said, listen, I actually used to play a bit of sport, and I've got a coaching background. So the poor old Kez, she met me thinking I was a bushy, love the bush, which I do love the bush, but she probably didn't think she'd be on this journey now, which Josh was 2 weeks old when I first started coaching, and that was at the Institute of Sport. I did a graduate diploma there. I was a coach on scholarship there in 1994.
So what program would that have been? Would AIS have had rugby stuff or...?
Yeah, they did. So rugby was introduced into the Institute of Sport in 1988, and I was one of the first. We had 60 athletes in there. I was one of the first players to come through. It was a decentralized program. I had 3 years in that program as a player, but because of my knee injuries, I only managed to play 13 games in 3 years, and that's when I decided, listen, this is not going to work for me. So. But they also had this coach on scholarship program, which was a brilliant program. Mm-hmm. There were 17 sports, hockey, volleyball, basketball, netball, gymnastics, you name it. And rugby was one of those. And they had a graduate diploma for each sport. You get one coach nominated per year. And I was lucky enough to be the rugby coach nominated. And I did that in 1994, 1995. Did my graduate diploma through the Institute of Sport, and that sort of launched me into the rest of my career.
That would have been fascinating because, you know, now we talk about information being free. I can Google anything that I want. I can get it. But back then when the internet was you know, still floundering and not as productive as it is now, you would have had access to all those coaches, all that IP, seeing. And at that stage, Australia was renowned for bringing in coaches from around the world to come and work in the Institute system. That would have been a fantastic grounding.
Oh, listen, it was, again, if I think back on it, I couldn't have had a better grounding, to be honest with you. It was, and as you say, in that era, you know, knowledge was king. Everyone, it was all about knowledge. You had to attain knowledge as quickly and as best you could. Whereas nowadays, as you say, with the advent of internet and all the different platforms we've got, knowledge isn't king. Everyone's got the knowledge. It's how you use the knowledge. Yeah. So, yeah, that gave me a great grounding in that. And if I back that onto my formal learning through University of Canberra, certainly from a theoretical point of view, I had the basis. But as we know, knowing what to do and then actually being able to implement it are two different things. So I'm still learning, mate. It's now I'm into my 26th year of coaching. And I'm still learning.
Yeah, well, that's fantastic. So then, so you're at Canberra. What happens with, how do you get into the Waratahs system?
So I had a year there at the Institute of Sport, and then the then manager of the Waratahs, who then went on to be the head coach there, Matt Williams, had seen some of the stuff I was doing there. I was lucky enough, we had seven players in Canberra. Four of the players you will never have heard of, but three of them, Justin Harrison, Joe Roff and Steve Larkham, all went on to be pretty well-known Wallabies. So in my first group of players that I worked with, those three men were there, and we had some reasonable success with those blokes, and that obviously sparked interest from the Waratahs. I went to the Waratahs and I had a four-year stint with them, starting off as a developing elite teams coordinator was my title, that I then moved into being a skills coach for my last 2 years of that.
So that was the actual position, skills coach, because I thought that was a more recent type of real sort of backs and forwards kind of stuff.
Well, no, that was back in 88, 89. So I was a skills coach in 88, 89.
Wow.
I then realized that I needed to move. I felt like I was getting stale. I responded, I never used to buy the newspaper and still don't buy the newspaper. But this weekend we did buy the newspaper, and there was an ad in the back of the paper saying, backs coach wanted in Japan.
Yep.
And I applied, it had a phone number. So I rang the phone number, and the bloke on the other end of the phone was Eddie Jones. I'd never met Eddie before.
Had you heard of him?
I had, because he was a Brumbies coach at the time.
Okay. So, yep.
And we were playing him the next week, actually. So I very much knew who he was. But a few days before Brumbies were to play the Waratahs, I met Eddie in a hotel room and, gave him a CV, had a chat, and he then offered me a job over there in Japan. So I went across there for an 8-week stint, and that worked out successfully. So my wife and my two boys then came over and joined us. We had three very good years in Japan. That was 99 to 2002. And that was sort of when everything sort of took off from there.
Okay. And then, so how did you find coaching in Japan? Because I know there would have been a few South Africans, Kiwis, Aussies there in your team, or were they mainly Japanese?
Less South Africans. South Africa rugby hadn't really opened up to the world at that stage. It was a little bit it had, but not as prevalent as it is now. But a lot of Kiwis and Aussies over there. But more importantly, you know, it's a competition in Japan. So I really wanted to engage with the Japanese, and I learned to speak Japanese, learned to get my message across via their native tongue, which I thought was really important. Culturally very, very different to any place I'd ever been before. And certainly for us as a young family, Josh was 5 years of age, Jackson was 3 years of age. To be plonked in the middle of Tokyo, 38 million people, was pretty daunting for us, but we managed to get through and had three really, really fantastic years there.
And was your position head coach then?
My position title was coaching coordinator. Okay. And the way it worked, we had a kontoku, which is Japanese for the big boss. So the kontoku was an employee of Suntory. I worked for the Suntory branch. Masato Tsuchita-san, his name was, and he was a brilliant bloke, actually a really, really good mentor for me. I was the only full-time employee there. So I'd get there at 9 in the morning and I'd work through till about 10 in the evening. And the players were all employees of Suntory. They were salespeople of Suntory. We had a few professional players, the likes of Jamie Washington, Alama Iramiya. a few reasonably well-known names back then. So I trained them through the day, just doing individual skills and weight stuff. And then the company boys would come in around about 3 o'clock, and then we'd have the whole afternoon, evening training. And yeah, it was fantastic time. Busy, really busy. And the Japanese, their work ethic is quite phenomenal. So learned to have to pull the brakes on there and say, listen, you've got to have balance in life too. And so I attempted to do that as best I could, but I got a very patient wife, and she managed to work with me on that one.
So that would have been a great experience to be across everything. Like if you're doing the S&C with some players, you're doing the skill work. You've so far, like I'm just hearing a lot of great places where you are building some, you're accelerating your career and your knowledge more than your peers, I'm guessing.
Well, I think that was one of the great things in Japan. I mean, I counted up at the end of my second year there, we had a 52-week season. That's the whole year. So we started in the first week of April, and we finished in the last week of March the next year. And I counted 200 on-field sessions in that year. Now, and of those on-field sessions, they would easily run for 2 hours. That's the Japanese way. In fact, they used to run for 4 hours, and we managed to bring that back to about 2.5 hours. But you know, you do the maths on that. That's a lot of coaching. That's a lot of hands-on stuff. And that's what I saw as a young coach. I saw that great opportunity to be able to get over there and you know, get that experience of being on the ground and getting all of that great on-field coaching experience. So that was one of the real pluses for me going over there, was mm-hmm. to do that. And probably the other big plus, you know, I mentioned the language there, but you don't realize until you're trying to coach in a native tongue how much we waffle. So your message had to become really succinct.
Yep.
And when I say I speak Japanese, I speak a coaching version of Japanese. Mm-hmm. Masugu, hidari, nigi, you know, go straight, go left, go right, hayaku, run quicker. But you know, but you're really to the point with your message when you're talking to your players. So that was pretty powerful learning for me as well.
Yes, because you know, I think that 10,000 hours. The original research didn't say what the popular press said, but there's still an element of that of just practicing, and it's interesting because I look at coaching today, especially the coaching courses, the degrees. You go to university, it's 4 years. You come out, you don't get a job. You go back and you get your master's in high performance. That's another 2 years or 18 months, whatever it is. It's almost like we've lost that, hey, let's just get our hands dirty, iterate feedback. Let's create as many of those loops as possible. But your career is an example of don't do that. You know, don't do the academic 6 years of study and then kind of come out and you actually haven't even coached a 16-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, I think, the theory is important. You need to know it. We talked at the front end there that, you know, knowledge was king. Everyone knows it now, but everyone knows what most people know. It's not what you do, it's how you do it. And yeah. The only way you get better at how you do it is by practicing and making those errors on the field and making those errors in the relationships, in the conversations, in your halftime deliveries, in your pre-match talks, in your emotional, you know, pulling apart of a game at the end of it, and you think, why the hell did I do that? But you've got to experience that in order to realize what it either worked or it didn't work. So, you know, on reflection, I was very fortunate to have had all of that experience, and I certainly I invited the opportunity to put myself into those situations as much as I could.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Okay, so then an opportunity to move across to an English-speaking country, Harlequins. How did that eventuate?
Well, I came back from Japan in 2002. I then was back with the Waratahs, and I was assistant coach then to Bob Dwyer, and I worked with Bob for a year and a half, and then at the same time I was working with Eddie with the Wallabies in the 2003 World Cup and the build-up to that. Ewan McKenzie then came in, Bob moved on, Ewan McKenzie came in, and I then ended up getting my first sacking. So Ewan and I, Ewan gave me my marching orders at the end of 2004. And that was a real shock. Like as a coach, I probably never thought I'd get sacked foolishly.
Well, that's interesting. Because as a young coach, we often, there's progress, isn't there? You, whether you're working with the 16s and then the 18s and the 20s, or in your, or in some cases, it's amateur, semi-professional, professional, and then it is a tough one. What have you learned in the, in you know, now you are the sacker, and although there's a board and a CEO above you, but you could pull the trigger on someone's career. What have you learned from back then till now?
Well, I think the first thing is no one's indispensable. So, you know, a program will exist whether, and as much as you probably feel like, listen, I contribute really well to this program, it's just like turning off a tap. One day I felt like I was massively involved and hands-on with what was going on, and that, you know, I felt like I had a significant role to play there. And
the next day, feedback on, you know, hey, was it something you could control, or was it something like, hey, I've got a buddy, or I want someone who's got different skills, or?
This was the bizarre thing with it, and it taught me a lot about, again, relationships, and as a head coach, how you've got to have conversations. So, in all honesty, I knew nothing about me about to be sacked until the day I walked into that office, till the minute I walked in that office, and he said, we have no synergy. There is a letter of resignation, a letter of termination. And I was like, what the hell is this about? And at the same time, they were basically saying, you must be out of the office within an hour. It was like I'd committed some crime. And it was, I just remember being really shocked with the whole thing. And, you know, as I said to him later, I said, you'd never spoken to me. And he said, it came upon me. And it was really bizarre. So I remember right then and there thinking, if I ever become a head coach, or when I become a head coach, it'll never be a surprise to somebody. If we're not working well together, there'll be a process where that person is informed. I'm able to listen to what their concerns may be. I'm able to listen to what their reason is for doing something, but they'll be very aware of what my concerns are and how we can try and progress that. Because when it was just dumped upon me, I found that really, really tricky to handle. So, but that was the way it was done. I think, again, life gives you some amazing opportunities to reflect. And sadly, my grandfather passed away about 3 days after that. And my grandfather had an amazing capacity to make you stop and think. He was a wool classer, so it wasn't like he was massively educated, but he was very, very good at what he did. And his passion was sheep, and his passion was classing wool. And when Pop then passed away, it made me stop and think and thought, actually, it's just a job. And actually, I didn't feel like I'd been informed correctly as to what was going on. And I probably, a lot of the bitterness that I had towards myself and what had just happened and towards what had happened just sort of dissipated. And I was went, oh, well, it's just a bloody job. Get on with it and move on to something else. So I got a real good lesson from Pop on that one. It's not what happens to you, it's how you deal with it, and move on as quickly as you can. So I did that, and that's when Harlequins became available, that opportunity to get to Harlequins, which was in July 2005. I moved over there with the family.
All right. And so this is now your first, you've been a coaching coordinator, but this is your first full-time gig as a head coach. How prepared were you for that?
I thought I was prepared, but you're never as prepared as you probably should be, but you know, you don't know what you don't know. I think that's the most important thing there. But you know, I was really keen to get myself into a head coaching role. I was really fortunate at Harlequins on a couple of fronts. One, we had a director of rugby in Dean Richards, and Dino was a very well-known ex-rugby player and a well-known director of rugby. But more importantly, Harlequins, before I got there, had just been relegated. So I was fortunate enough to still be able to be offered the job, because when I'd come over for the interview, it had looked like that Harlequins were going to be relegated and they may not have this job, but they decided to push on with it. So my first year there, it was a little bit out of the spotlight. It was in the spotlight in that Harlequins, this well-established club in London, were now playing championship football, mm-hmm. but we didn't have the pressure that we would have had if we were in the championship, in the premiership. So we went on to win 35 out of 36 games, and it gave me an easy transition in where we'd actually change a lot of the personnel that were there. And then we, after 12 months, we got back into the premiership. And so it was an easy, on reflection, it was an easier transition into head coaching. But like any head coach, made a lot of errors along the way.
Any particular that stand out that you've learned from?
I think it's more, I was always really keen as a head coach to, especially if there was, if you're going to drop somebody or cut somebody, I was really keen to make sure that that the player was under no illusions as to why that was about to happen to them. And I think the honesty with that
applying a similar principle to how you deal with your staff, same thing, the process.
Very similar. Yeah, very similar. And I probably learned this is that you're never dishonest. Don't ever be dishonest to players because that bites you on the backside. So never ever be dishonest, but you don't have to be as honest as you think you need to be. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the best things I learned as a young head coach. You don't have to divulge everything, because you sometimes you know why you're doing, you're trying to assist, but sometimes those words can cut really deep. And, the spoken words like the spent arrow, you can't get it back.
Yep.
And quite often, certainly as a young coach, I was trying to get too much information.
What was that, for the player's benefit or for your own benefit to kind of justify your own decision, or are you trying to help them?
It was always for the players because, again, and we're all different, but the more honest someone can be to me, the more I respect that. But I've subsequently learned that I'm a little bit, we're all different and not a lot of people like that real direct feedback. And I think that one of the most important things is to, is to seek an understanding as to what every individual person's like and what they respond to. It's not what you respond to, it's what they respond to. So early on in my coaching career, definitely guilty of probably trying to give too much information there and maybe burnt some bridges that never got rebuilt.
Okay. I've got a question and it's come in privately here. Have you had an instant where you've sat down with a coach, had the conversation, so this is in the sort of, hey, there's a sacking on the horizon, I'm guessing. And so have you had an instance where you've sat down with a coach and had the conversation and seen progress in the relationship and synergy, and then did not follow through with terminating the position?
With a coach, I haven't had that. But I haven't sacked any coaches either. So, but I haven't had that. I certainly had that with players. And I think if I think back to my first sacking there, had I been aware of what Ewan wasn't seeing or what he was concerned about in my behaviour at the time, I would have been able to work with that. But I've had many conversations with a player around exactly that. I had one just 12 months ago where I sat down with a player, took a player out for dinner, and he's one of our better known players. And I said to him, listen, I love you. I reckon you're great for this group. You've got one more year left on your contract. But if your current actions and behaviours, I'm not going to re-sign you for that. So things are going to have to change. And we had a really healthy conversation over dinner. It took about 2 hours and he shared some things with me. I shared some thoughts with him. He then put a program in place and some adjustments in place. And 3 months into the season, we signed him and signed him for another 2 years. So I think just by, again, sometimes we assume that people understand the way we're thinking and they understand what our frustrations are, but more times than not, they don't. So you've got to have the conversation and it doesn't have to be, I call them real conversations. It's not I never go into a conversation, so I'm going to have an honest conversation with you. I'm going to have a tough conversation with you because you preempt what that conversation is going to be about. A tough conversation, if someone says that to you, straight away you sit back and go, what's going on here? Or an honest conversation, you go, does that mean you're not honest normally? But if you can just say, listen, we're going to have a real conversation here and then have the conversation, there's no parameters on that. And there's no, you're not trying to set an, there's not an adjective to that as to what you want them to feel other than just, I'm going to tell you what's actually happening here. So I've had many a conversation like that where I've been able to sit down with a player and share what my concerns are, listen to what their concerns are, come to some middle ground, a win-win for both. And then it's up to the behaviours that then transpire out of that conversation as to see whether we retain them or whether we move them on.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. No, I'm interested in your time at the Brumbies, specifically because not the coach prior to you, but the one before that had got sacked mid-season, seemed to be player-driven. They then go on to win the championship. Was there any trepidation returning to Canberra to coach them, knowing that there's that a bit of history where the players could turn on you?
No, not an ounce, to be honest with you. Not an ounce of trepidation there. It's my hometown. It's my home club. It was probably my dream job. So, you know, with a lot of excitement, we accepted the position. We're really, really looking forward to getting back there. And again, to cut to the chase on that, 2.5 years later, I'm sacked again for the second time. But that was under very different circumstances, that one.
Can you expand on that? Like, I'm not interested in the performance of it. I'm just more interested in how you handled it and what were the constraints that sort of led to that?
Well, I learned one of my biggest lessons in coaching on that one. Again, I went back into that program, and I'm a very values-driven person. Like, I live on what I believe are pretty simple values and principles. And it's the way I believe things should be done. And I'm massive on culture. My lesson there, though, I tried to set the culture. And it wasn't a bad culture. So the values we were talking about were values like personal responsibility and respect for others, and the next thing's the best thing you do, and living above the line. Just simple things. But my lesson with that was, you only really get buying if people have had involvement in something. Mm-hmm. So here I was in a culture that I thought was different to what it was, and it was a fractured culture. It really was. Hence the reason, it was David Nusafora who got sacked a couple of years beforehand. Mm-hmm. And they'd had this losing mentality ever since then. And I probably didn't appreciate the significance of the cultural change that needed to take place, nor did I appreciate how much better it would have been had I involved the players and all the staff in setting these values. And I have no doubt that some of the values that I'd set probably would have been very similar to the ones that we would have got to. But
yep.
The mere fact that we'd invited their input to that, we would have had their skin in the game rather than me trying to enforce that. So that was a great lesson, a difficult lesson at the time, but a great lesson to have learned around that one too.
Have you carried on that lesson? Because in sport, whether we're talking about state or state sporting organizations, national sporting organizations, there is very much this top-down approach, the century, that comes through so often. We've been talking about it quite a bit, the Hollywood coach who drives everything, the press love that kind of stuff. Do you find you more of a sort of bottoms-up kind of coach and get the guys almost letting them lead the way?
Yeah, I do. And, my style, and certainly if you'd had the last 18 months or 2 years here at Connacht, you'd see my style very clearly, which is, it's not my footy team, it's our footy team. And at the end of the day, I'm in the chair that makes the final decisions, but I want people's input. And I recently read a book, The Team of Teams, General Stanley McChrystal, and he talks about the Gardner approach. It's eyes on, hands off. So my eyes are on everything, but I can touch if I feel like it. But if we put the right people in places, so whether that's staff or whether that's leadership groups or captains, and we give them the space to make decisions and open up their opportunity to make decisions, we get this collective buy-in to what it is that we're trying to do. So massively important is the cultural piece, I believe, but having everybody's input into that is really, really important. And we've currently got a set of behaviours here, values, behaviours. We call them behaviours now, but they've been actually established. We all had input into it, staff and players, but our leadership group came up with the final set of them. And there's four really simple ones. One is prepare to win. So do everything you can to prepare to win. Second one is know your shit, in terms of not your bad, but know your stuff, basically. Know what you're meant to be doing and do it. Number three is be prepared to challenge and be challenged. And number four, which was really simple, don't be a dick. And again, that's their words. Now, and they said to me, is that okay? And I said, if that's what you blokes want, you do it. It makes sense to me. So that's what we live by now. But what's really important is,
uh-oh, Andy, we seem to have lost you. I'm just gonna, have we only lost Andy or have we lost everyone? Oh, sorry, Andy, we just lost you for about 30 seconds.
Right, you got me back.
I got you back. So we've got Don't Be a Dick, that they had input into that. And then, sorry, I lost you there. Andy?
You got me now.
Okay, I think, I think we, all right. So did you feel that it was similar to Nusafora, that in terms of the players and some kind of disconnect there with your sacking?
No, I didn't. I think it probably, and I'm not prepared to comment on David's situation because I wasn't there, you know, and you hear different versions of what happened, but you've got to have walked in those shoes or lived in that environment to really know what happened there. But, and I know David very well. He's over here now at Irish Island Rugby. He's the head of high performance here. So, but we've never discussed it, and we probably will never discuss it. But the other big thing that my sacking taught me was the relationship between the coach and the CEO. And that has to be rock solid. Mm-hmm. You have to have each other's back on that. And if you don't, you know, and you open up a crack, if you've got, and listen, every group of players, every group of staff, there will be some in there that if you give them an opening, they'll flood through it and they can make life difficult for you. So the key is not to give them openings, and just to, when you walk out of a room, that you're both, everyone's aligned, your chairman, your CEO, your captain, and your coach, those four relationships have to be rock solid. Mm-hmm. And on reflection, they weren't rock solid. And the you know, the subsequent sackings and the way the team played is a result of that.
Okay. So Andy, I'm interested a little bit in your time with the Sevens, because it falls under Rugby Australia or Rugby Union or whatever, but it's a totally different sport. Tell me a bit about your thinking going into that to take on a new challenge, which, yeah, it's the same field, same ball, I guess, but that's kind of where it stops.
I hadn't had a great deal of experience. In fact, I'd had 2 weeks of Sevens experience prior to that, and that was back in 2005, just before I went to Harlequins. I went across to Wellington and LA with the Aussie Sevens. And I really enjoyed those two tournaments. But wind the clock forward now to 2016, and I've been to Hong Kong Sevens to watch it as a punter. You know, I used to watch whatever Sevens was on footy, but was on telly, sorry. But I'd never actually spent time looking at the intricacies of Sevens rugby. And probably the best way to describe it is you know, you can paddle a canoe or a kayak. You could be on still water, or you could be on the slalom on the fast water. You're still a kayak, a paddler of a kayak, but they're two very different sports. And it's the exact same, I reckon, with Sevens. You know, they're two. It's rugby union under the same umbrella. But one's on still water. That's the 15s. Just go forward as fast as you can, as hard as you can, and normally the most powerful wins. Or you're on fast water, and it is, you've got to have your mind on the job, because you make one error and you're out. You're gone. You miss that gate, you're gone. So when I went into that job, I knew it was going to be different. And I went into that job 7 months out from Rio to the Olympics. So coming in as a new coach, new sport, knowing that we're going to be heading to Rio, I was on the world's steepest curve. And, you know, I'd wake up midnight, middle of the night, thinking new tactics, thinking conversations I'd had, thinking how I hadn't seen that, and selections and so on and so forth. Really invigorating, really, really frightening in some aspects. But after 21 years of coaching in the 15s sport, was probably exactly what I needed to reignite my energy and my love for the game of rugby in a different version.
And so, were there any things that you found that you went and there were some preconceived ideas and then found this doesn't work at all? And likewise, did you feel that maybe with a stronger professional coaching background that you could add to the sevens environment?
I think one of the biggest things that it taught me there is to lean on the expertise of those around you. You know, I think quite often as a coach, we feel like you've got to have all the answers, and you don't. You actually don't. A little bit like being a parent. You feel like you know your kid asks you a question, you've got to have the answer to that. Well, you don't. You may not have it. You may have the answer. If you do, you can share it. But the more you can lean on others around you and open up different ways of thinking and to show vulnerability, to say, I actually don't know that. I don't know what you're thinking. I don't know why that is the case, but I'm happy to explore it. So it was a really good opportunity for me I had thoughts on certain things, on tactics, on the way we wanted to play, on different skills that I thought were really important for the game.
And where did those thoughts come from? Where did those original thoughts come from?
Came out of my 15s, my understanding of 15s, with the 15s game. Ways that I thought we should be training better in order to be fitter for this new high octane game that we're about to play. But some of those thoughts were good and they actually added value, but some of them was a waste of time and a waste of space. So it made me stop and think that again. You know, you feel like you've got good experience in an area, but sometimes we're only just scratching the surface of what we know, and it's what you don't know that is going to make you stronger.
Has there been anything that, like, lessons from there that you think, and I'm talking maybe specifically technically, tactically, that you think has made you a better coach coming back to the 15s? Is there anything that you can borrow or steal?
Yeah, I think certainly the attention to detail around the skills was really important. So you make an error in sevens and it's normally going to cost you possession, which therefore normally costs you points. You make an error in 15s, you've got a fair chance of getting the ball back, or it's probably not going to hurt you as much. But yeah, so my attention on the intricacies of doing simple things like your catch and pass, having your hands up, like the way when you get tackled, how you land, how you work on the ground, the speed and arrival of the support player, your delivery of that next ball, your speed of reload and da-da-da, your entry into a tackle, all the simple things around the game of rugby got magnified and you had to be really, really accurate with those. So that definitely, from a technical point of view, that definitely highlighted my vision back onto the intricacies of those skills. From a tactical point of view, again, simple's best. And the simpler you could do things on a sevens field. And so we basically just played a game of switches. We'd have our halfback running out, we'd drop someone underneath, or we'd pass to the first receiver, we'd drop someone underneath, or we'd pass to the second receiver, we'd drop someone underneath. We just ran simple switch plays, but we became really good at it. We became really good at running what we call a skinny switch or a deep switch. And it became very, very hard to defend, to the point where just near the end of my tenure there at the Aussie Sevens, a lot of coaches coming up and saying, what are you blokes doing in attack? And when I explained to them, it's so simple, we just run switches, they were like, seriously? And then they'd watch and they go, it is simple. Yeah, it is simple. And normally the best plans are simple. So it allowed me just to go back to, you know, not trying to be complicated with what we were doing, be really, really good at the simple things and do those really well. And everyone had real clarity around what we were doing, and we tended to have pretty good success with that.
And mindset-wise, were you thinking of pivoting or repositioning yourself as a sevens coach, or was this kind of interim until a 15s opportunity came about?
Well, it really came about, I was back in Japan, so I had another 4 years back in Japan, and it was sort of mid-2015, my wife... she wasn't enjoying her time there at all. So she went back to Australia and I was looking for an opportunity to get back home. My contract in Japan was coming to an end by the end of January 2016, and this opportunity presented itself. So, in all honesty, it was an opportunity to get home. It was an opportunity to get back home and to try and be with the family. Now, the only downside of that was our family house is in Canberra, and this position was in Sydney. So I got home, but I was in Sydney, not in Canberra. So we had another 2.5 years apart, which was a bugger. It was identified that it looked like Sevens was going to be the avenue to get home. That just added the excitement of coming into a new sport, which I really, really enjoyed.
Has that experience and the success that you had with those Sevens opened your eyes or given you confidence to maybe explore another sport later on in your career, whether it could be league or something like that?
Yeah, I think a lot of the skills that we gather as a head coach, you can cross fertilize into different sports. You know, I think I spent a bit of time with AFL. It's, you know, as a young kid, we lived in Melbourne for a while too. So I'm a mad Bomber supporter for all those people who are Bomber supporters. Good on you. But listen, I love AFL. I spent some time with John Worsfold just before I came over here to Connacht. And a lot of the conversations they're having, a lot of the I don't know AFL anywhere near as well as I know rugby, but certainly the human side of that, the conversations around with players or with coaches around your planning things and around your the way you're setting up a week are very, very similar. So it's basically just man management, really. It's in a sporting aspect, and I certainly would not I wouldn't be frightened to move into another sport, put it that way.
That kind of leads me to my next question. Is you've been a head coach for a long time. You've been in some of the most, competitive leagues and competitions. Where do you go for self-improvement, professional development, spark some ideas?
Wherever I can. And so, I think one of the things that, again, I said at the front end of this chat, I certainly don't profess to know everything. In fact, every day is a learning day for me. And I really mean that. I go for a walk every morning. Certainly in this period, it's every morning. Prior to this period, it was every evening. I did a diploma last year in executive coaching and leadership, which, as a full-time head coach over here in a pretty full-on competition, I knew it was going to be challenging for me, but I was quite comfortable to stretch myself with that. But it got me into really good...
Aside from the certification and the actual piece of paper, did you gain much or did you...
I gained a hell of a lot, mate. One of the best things I gained, and again, this is... I'm just about to enter into my... I'm in my 26th year of coaching. But last year, that course taught me the difference between coaching, the definition of coaching, true definition of coaching, the true definition of mentoring, the true definition of being a consultant. And when we went into the course, they said, define coaching for me. And so I gave, I've been doing this for 20, 25 years. Here's what coaching is. Like, no, what's the true definition? I'm like, what are you talking about? And it became very evident to me then, well, the true definition of coaching is I don't deliver you any answers. You hold all the answers. I'm just going to ask the right questions to allow you to realize that you hold the answers. Mm-hmm. So the true definition of coaching is that I'm here to listen. I'm here to ask powerful questions for you and for allow you to find your own way. Mentoring, slightly different. I'm here to listen. I'm here to try and seek to understand where you're coming from. But at the same time, if you would like me to share my experiences, I can share that. And collectively, we might be able to find a route through this this problem you may have or where you want to head. Consultancy, totally different. I'm here to tell you. I'm going to tell you what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so, really simply it was probably even my second day on the course there. It was this real light bulb moment for me thinking, well, my coaching is a blend of all of those. Sometimes I listen, sometimes I'm truly coaching, sometimes I'm mentoring, sometimes half time I'm telling you, this is what needs to happen right now. It's what we've got to do. But just having that definition and that clarity in my own mind as to what phase of what I would consider normally coaching being is really, really important. I've used that, you know, quite significantly and quite substantially since I learnt that.
Yeah, some more notes that I've just written. I really like that. I want to explore that a little bit more. So Andy, when you looking at this, the professional development, you look at all these kind of things, what are you looking for when you select a staff member? What are the characteristics, qualifications, experiences that you're looking for with your intrigue and your background and variety of different sports? What complements that?
Well, firstly, I think you've got to be good at whatever we're trying to recruit. So, if we're trying to recruit a nutritionist, which we did recently, needs to know his stuff. Needs to know, and go back to what our players have termed, know your shit. Mm-hmm. So know what you're meant to know. You know, have a deep understanding of the area of expertise that you profess to have an understanding in. That's really important. And then it probably goes to all those other behaviours. You know, is this person now a good person? Is it a person who's coming in here to add value to the organisation, not to take value out of the organisation? Can they be proactive? Can they actually? It's one of the things I talk about culture. Culture to me, you know, when your culture's working, when things are happening, when no one's watching. Mm-hmm. So at the moment, through COVID, this is a brilliant opportunity for us to get a really good test on our culture. And I will say, 8-7 weeks into this lockdown period, the Connacht culture is working well. We've got a lot of staff and players who are just getting on with their stuff. Mm-hmm. We're not there holding a big stick over their head saying, do this, do that. But we're engaged. We're continuously learning. People are getting on with the things that they're meant to be doing. So when you're looking for a staff member, do they have that proactivity to be able to self-drive and to do the stuff? And then I want them to own their area. You know, again, when I first came in here, I said to our coaching staff,
coaching staff?
No, I didn't select any of them. So what had happened, there was a previous coach here who had signed a 3-year contract, but he was moved on after a year. So all those coaches had linked in with him. So when I came in, I inherited the whole staff. But again, knowing that, knowing what I was walking into, and having had the experience as an assistant coach and as a previous head coach too, my style was very different with that. So the last thing, and I always try and put myself in the shoes of an assistant coach or a player or whoever I'm having a conversation with. If I was an assistant coach, the last thing I would want to do is the new bloke coming in and telling me how he wanted me to run a defensive system. Mm-hmm. Be the last thing I'd want. Similarly, I was the attack coach. So what I simply said to these blokes who I'd never met, I met them over the phone, and I said, listen, I'm going to arrive in 3 weeks' time. On the first day I get here, we'll have a sit down as a collective group, and you've all got half an hour. And what I want you to do, I want you to tell me how you want to run the defensive system, or the attack system, or the breakdown system, whatever the system was, your medical system, your athletic performance system, whatever it was. You explain to me your logic, give me the why you're doing it, how you're going to do it, and what the purpose of it is for. If it makes sense to me, I'll buy into it. But you got to sell it to me. So we sat down, we had 4 hours when I first got here on the first day. Everyone delivered their stuff. I asked a few questions through the course of the presentations, but everyone had done a lot of work on it. And it actually made really good sense to me. You know, if I say to you, Grant, what's 3 + 7?
10.
What's 2 + 8?
10.
Yeah, so we end up at the same point, but there's two different ways of getting there. Yep. So the whole thing was, can we get to the same point? And the same point is that we're producing a performance on a weekend that we're proud of. So I could come in here and say it's 5 + 5. We can get to 10 that way if we want. But you know what? If your 7 + 3 makes sense to me, I'll back you. Go and do that. If your 8 + 2 makes sense to me, I'll back you. Go and do that. So I came in and I said, you know, you tell me if it makes sense, go and do it. It made perfect sense. So we gave the staff autonomy where they owned their area. They knew, again, as the gardener, my eyes were on them. I knew what they were thinking, but my hands were off. And we'd still have conversations. I might make a suggestion here, or they may come to me and say, have you seen another way? Back to the mentoring. Yeah, I may have seen another way, and I'm happy to share that with you. So it became a really collaborative approach towards how we got to where we were going, or how we started to get to where we were going. But, you know, to me, that would be far more effective than me coming in and saying, this is the way we're going to do it.
Yep.
You know, I often use the analogy, more than analogy, we actually do this in practice, because at the time we couldn't speak Japanese when we first moved to Japan. We'd go out for dinner and we learned a really useful phrase early on, which is osusume o negaishimasu, which basically means give me your recommendation. So we walk into a Japanese restaurant when we're over there, osusume o negaishimasu, and we never had a bad meal. Mm-hmm. And we actually use that tactic wherever we travel around the world now, where we go, you feed us your recommendation. And if you think about it logically, you're basically walking into someone's shop and you're saying, you cook me your best dish and you give it to me, and you know it's going to be a good dish because you've basically given them a compliment before you've even started. Yep. It's something they're really, really good at doing. And they're going to sit there and say, I really want to make this bloke who's actually invited me to make my best dish for him. I'm going to give it to him, he and his wife, and they're going to have a great night. Well, it's very similar with coaching. So we walk in and you say, you tell me how good you can be at this. And then sit back. You'll be amazed sometimes at what people come up with. Mm-hmm. But then be there to support them and to maybe nurture them and guide them in other areas. But for me, that's the way that I always wanted to be respected as an assistant coach and as a head coach. That's the way I try and treat people.
All right. Well, I've got a question come through. It's an anonymous question, but Andy, I have to apologize. When I was saying you broke up, I got a truckload of messages saying, no, it was me that broke up. You were loud and clear. So everyone else heard except me. Anonymous question, and it's on the same topic here. It says, hey, Andy, as a young strength coach, always interested to hear from a rugby coach in the pro game, what do you look for in your strength and conditioning staff that you think makes a good or a bad S&C?
Yeah, I think, listen, the first thing, at the end of the day, we are judged on how well we perform on a Saturday. We're not judged on how much weight we can lift. We're not judged on how lean our players look. We're not judged on how quick they run. It's how well we perform. So I've worked with some athletic performance S&C coaches, and I get it too. I used to be involved in the S&C part of it too, but it's nice to see your players lifting heavier. And it's nice to see your players, you know, when you compare them to other provinces, for example, and say, well, we got the fittest, or we got the quickest, or we got the leanest. Sometimes that's really important, but if it doesn't help performance, it means nothing. So what I'm looking for is a athletic performance coach, strength and conditioning coach, who is aware of that, but more importantly is aware of the end game. And that is that performance we've got to deliver on the weekend, and how can we best do that? So that's the starting point, is the performance. And what do we need from our athletes in order to get that? It may be additional strength. It may be additional power, additional speed, more lean muscle mass, less fat, for example. But we work back from that. But we don't work in, I'm going to create this animal and now turn him into a good footballer for us. We work back the other way. So I'm looking for someone who has that general understanding, to be honest. And then there's always an area that I'm always looking for is a real strength in a strength and conditioning coach. So is it their ability to produce a powerful athlete? Is it their ability to work on recon and recovery? Is it their ability to work on speed? Could be one of those, but I believe every S&C coach, good one that I've ever worked with, they've had a real slant towards an area, which is normally something that we're looking for within that program.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's a great answer. We've got another question from Simon, but Simon, I'm going to ask that question at the end because it sounds like a good one. It also sounds, Simon's got a habit of asking leading questions, so I think there's a history behind it, but I'm not sure. Andy, being a head coach for so long, do you have any, what would it take for you to say, hey, yep, I'll jump on board as an assistant coach? What would the circumstances be for that?
Are
there circumstances?
Say again?
Are there circumstances that you would, or would you?
I think if you, you know, if you felt it was the right environment for you. I think the other thing though, Grant, you know, as I've gone through my coaching, similar to what I just said to you there, I think, you know, with strength coaches, everyone's probably got a, I call them our weapons. So you, everyone's got a weapon. And I ask this to our players, what's your weapon? And they look at me sometimes, what are you talking about? So, well, what got you selected into this program? What was the one trait that you possessed that someone saw that said, before I got here, that said that person's going to be good? And I said, oh, well, it'd be my evasion skills, for example. Right on. So that's your weapon. And he said, yeah. So what skill could you be world-class at? And then zone in on that. So if I look at my own, what I now consider my weapon would be more along the personal relationship side of things than it would be on the technical or tactical aspects of rugby. So in answer to your question, a long-winded way to do it, mate, I could easily fall back into that, but I know I wouldn't be maximizing my strength. My strength, I believe now, after, you know, my 26 years of coaching, is in building that rapport with a player and seeking to understand them more than for me to be understood, if that makes sense. So could I do that as an assistant coach? I could, but I think there's a heavier weighting as an assistant coach on the tactical and technical aspects of the game, whereas in a head coach role or a director of rugby role, it's more the personal side. So hopefully I've answered that for you. I wouldn't be shy of doing that, but I probably know deep down in my own heart of hearts that it wouldn't be my strength to go back to that now.
Well, I've got a challenge for you, because this is something that happened with me a few years ago. Do you know the comedian Louis C.K.?
I don't.
Okay. So, comedian, he's had a few Netflix specials. He's pretty funny. And he is it's interesting because these comedians, and if you watch and you look at the history of like a Jerry Seinfeld or a Louis C.K., they do what we kind of talked about right in the beginning, like your 200 hours or your 200 on-field sessions in Japan is that they've got a show, they get up, they bomb, and 2 hours later they get back on and iterate again and then use that feedback and try work on it. So when we look at a Seinfeld or a Netflix special, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's happened way back, and it's failure after failure, failing forward, all that kind of stuff. But one of the interesting things he's done is, so Louis C.K., to improve as a coach, apparently one of the things you do as a comedian is you end with your best stuff. So that just before they walk off stage, that's their best stuff. So he would challenge himself by putting that at the beginning of his show and then having to build from there. So where I apply this is, I think one of my strengths is my energy in the gym. I can create an atmosphere or whatever you want to call it. So for 6 weeks, Andy, I took that away from myself. I sat in the middle of the gym. We've got a glute ham raise, it's a bench, and I sat on that. And part of that energy and part of that culture is my connection with the coach or with the athletes. And I took that away from myself. So I just sat there as they came in, I waved or whatever. And it was really fascinating because that was my strength. And I was trying to almost bring up other parts of it. So I had to, what could I do from a distance? What could I do? Something like that. So to me, it's just a, you know, how do we, you're very clear with your strength, and I'd just be interested, put you in a place where you don't have that, like, you know, be defense or just be the line out guy. Go for that,
Jim. And listen, and that's what I had in Japan, because, you know, if my strength is communication, I didn't have that. I couldn't delve into the person. I couldn't seek to understand, because I didn't have the knowledge, I didn't have the language. So those, I ended up having 7 years in Japan. Pretty much those 7 years, I took away my strength, and I got stuck into the tactical and technical part of the sport, and I loved it. It was really, really good. But I said, I know deep down that I know what my strength is now. Yep. And could I do it? Yeah, I could. I could go back and do that. What would I be looking for? I'd be looking for a head coach who gave me autonomy.
Yep.
Who allowed me to be the chef. I'll cook me my specialty, but you give me the space to let me cook it. Yep. And then trust me on that.
So. That's awesome. That's a good place to be. Now, guys, we're going to be turning the mics off mute soon. So I'm going to, Andy, I'm going to ask you Simon's question, which, as I mentioned, I think is a loaded question. It's, I would love to hear your about your experience with the under 21s of 2005. Who impressed you in that cohort, and how did you enjoy coaching age group rugby?
I loved it. I did that. So that was before we went to Harlequins. I went.
Sorry. That's not Simon Price. That's another Simon. Just got it. It's another. So anyway, yeah. 2005 age group rugby.
2005. So Chris Hickey was the head coach. I was his assistant coach, and we went to Mendoza to Argentina, and we played in the World Cup Championship there, and we ended up losing to South Africa in the final. We had a brilliant team of young men, actually, some really, you know, some players that went on to be top line Wallabies. Ben Mohan was our captain. He was a very impressive individual back then, and as we all probably know, the rugby people here, and you know, you'd remember Ben's successes playing for the Wallabies, captain the Brumbies, came over to Europe and had some quality time over here. Yeah, he was one of a whole chunk of blokes who were just impressive individuals back then.
Okay. So Simon, hopefully that answers your question. So Andy, where you are now, 26 years of coaching, you've talked about man management. You've mentioned the differences between coaching, mentoring, and consulting. You've identified what your skills are. What are your thoughts on our coaching qualifications, both in where you're coaching now, Australia, where there seems to that would, if anything, that's the smallest component of your level one, level two, compared to the technical, tactical stuff.
Yeah, listen, I've held this belief for some time. I think it's one of the great pillars of rugby that hasn't been fed, you know, as well as grassroots, especially in Australia. If I talk Australia, you know, you think back to my experience as a young coach coming through the Institute of Sport and the support that I had there to build my skill set in coaching and to expose me to all the different nuances of coaching. But ever since then, I've just seen the support for coaches, I believe, has dropped away. I do think with Scott Johnson recently back in Australian rugby, it started to pick up again, which is a good thing. I think the theoretical practical side of the coaching courses is important, but there's nothing like just experience, getting out there and getting experience. But when you're getting that experience, how do you get the feedback? And one of the simplest ways of doing that is just to get someone to video you. Mm-hmm. Video you delivering a halftime speech. Video you delivering, you know, a pre-session warm-up or a pre-session, this is what we're about to do, feedback or feed-forward conversation with your players. Video, get someone to video you with your body language during the middle of a session and just see what you're doing. Because the only way we learn is actually being able to reflect upon what it is we're actually doing.
Yeah. I think it's funny. We use video, you know, especially with iPhones and coaches' eye and stuff quite a lot in gyms. With various sports, I'm involved with BMX. We use that on the start gate quite a bit. And I just think, yeah, videoing ourselves, am I waffling, you know, the warm-up was 10 minutes, but my explanation was 8. Like there's a disconnect there. There's something going on. All right, guys. If everyone can just, anyone who wants to ask a question, feel free to turn off your mic and ask Andy directly. Do you have a question for him? I'll give it a couple of seconds. Andy, while that's happening, what would you tell a young Andy friend?
I'd tell him to be patient. You know, you don't get there yesterday or tomorrow. It takes time. I'd tell him.
Were you impatient? Were you trying to rush processes?
I didn't think I was. I didn't think I was, but I certainly had ambitions of you know. We always used to get told, deliver a 5-year plan. What's your 5-year plan? I don't have one of those now. I really don't. I have what I'm going to do next week. And what I want to do at the end of the year. But I don't go beyond that. And my reason for not going beyond that, you're not in control. You think you are, but you're not in control. So having been sacked twice, that probably gave me that realization. So I don't try and build up this big 5-year plan where I want to be. I know what I want to do next week. And at the end of the season, I know what holiday I want to go on to. And that's all, honestly, that's all I look forward to. very clear vision as to where we want the team to get to at the start of any season, and we work through that, but that's as far as it gets. So that wasn't impatience, but I've met a lot of coaches, and they want to get there. They want to get there tomorrow.
Yep.
And I'll just say, chill on that one, because it doesn't take tomorrow. So that'll be one. I think the other big one is you don't have to have all the answers. And in fact, the quicker you realise you don't have to have the answers, the more comfortable you're going to be. So it's okay saying, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Or it's okay saying, no, I don't know that. I'll find out for you.
Yep.
And it wasn't, I never felt like I felt like I needed to have them, but certainly as a coach, the definition of a coach, my definition of a coach was you've got to provide the information. And I'm
now realizing,
yeah, that's not the case.
Yeah. I think we're seeing that as, especially as, you know, each of those subdivisions of rugby, whether it's forwards and backs and attack and defense and lineups and scrums and restarts, and you just can't. Yeah. Maybe a few years, well, 30 years ago, you could have. But well, Andy, I think you've answered all the questions, because there's no mics turning off their mute. Luke normally asks a pretty good question, but he seems to be silent there. So I just would like to thank you for your time. Thank you for your insights. It's been awesome having the chat and hearing some of those experiences. I've taken a whole bunch of notes here, so I really appreciate that. Oh, wait, there is a question.
Hey, Gar, sorry. Andy, this is Derek here. Just a quick question. How do you see the elections coming up with World Rugby, Pichot versus Bill Bowman's? Do you see that actually having any effect over the next little while? And how do you see the elections go one way or the other? Will it actually make any difference, do you think?
I'm sure it will. In all honesty, mate, I haven't paid too much attention to it. And it'll sound weird because I'm heavily involved in rugby, but I try and work as much as I can on what I call my circle of influence, and I don't have much influence on that. What will happen will happen. I know Pichot, and I know him as a bloke too. He's ambitious and he's pretty brave, and I think he will have a less conservative approach to the way the game goes and what needs to happen within the game of rugby union. So I think I'd probably be excited to see him come in, to be honest. I think, and that's no disrespect to Bill Bowman, I think, but just given his background with English Rugby Union and where he sits within it, it's probably going to be more conservative. So, but what happens and what transpires, in all honesty, mate, I haven't spent a great deal of time thinking about it.
All right. Cheers. Thanks.
Thanks, Derek, for your question. All right, Andy. You've got the rest of the day to get hold of. Us on the East Coast are probably heading to bed soon. Thanks again to everyone who tuned in. I've got Simon Thomas coming up, Stefan Widmar, and a whole bunch of others. So please keep in contact there. And we'll see you guys at the next one. Andy, thank you very much.
Good on you, mate. Thanks, Gareth. Appreciate it.
Bye. Cheers, Gareth.
Cheers.